The DL debate with Sister Sarah's Letterkenny, serving food you'll love till 9 p.m. daily in Sarah's Kitchen. And there's free admission entertainment every weekend. Check
this. It's Monday evening at 7 p.m. It's time for the DL debate. Hey folks, welcome one and all, wherever you might be in the world right now, and like myself, probably in-house and staying away and taking medical advice as we are here at Highland. Supposed to have people in the studio with me, John Harn and Rory Kavanagh were supposed to be joining me with Enda McGinley on the phone. We've decided to take, you know, health advice as we say, and no guests are coming in. They're all joining me on the line, so I'm all by myself here, just looking across at the lovely Kenneth. He's pushing the buttons and keeping me correct. Listen, the easy thing I suppose to do would have been to, you know, forget about it. And, you know, obviously the main thing you're listening to at the minute is news bulletins, etc., and they are the most important. But we just thought, you know, if everybody's at home, maybe there's a time there for a bit of a GA chat and a bit of GA show in the middle of it, just to lighten the spirits and take your mind off the current situation. So that's what we're aiming to do, and I hope we do that. And I'm glad to say, as I say, couldn't be in studio with me today, but I'm delighted to be joined on the line by the one and only John Harn, current club chairman of St Union's. How are you, John?
Good, Brendan. Good, yeah.
Good man, good man. Healthy, I didn't hear any snivelling at all there. John, tell me this, sir. I was just thinking, club chairman, a lot happening around the park. What's happening at the minute from in terms of the GAA and, you know, the response and the guidelines being given to them around all matters at the club?
I was, Brendan, I suppose it came last whatever day, was the last Wednesday that the GAA, or last Thursday, the day that we got the word that the schools were closing, and the GAA put out their directive the same night or the same time. So I suppose, Brendan, it maybe came as a wee bit sooner than we thought. You know, as a school principal here in the beginning, we had a meeting, and, you know, amongst the principals on the Wednesday, and we thought it'd be another maybe a week to 10 days before the schools closed, and then within 24 hours we were closed. But now, from the GAA point of view, Brendan, I suppose it was the correct decision. There was word of going behind closed doors for the National League games and that, but listen, everything's been ruled out, Brendan. I think it's the right call. And, you know, from our point of view out in O'Donnell Park, the same thing. Like, we just had to shut the gates and that, Brendan. No one's allowed in. You know, different managers were queuing. Could they send players down to the hurling wall, groups of two or three, or, you know, different things like that there. But we just had to call a blanket ban, Brendan, because, you know, people have the best intentions in the world, but listen, you just got to keep people apart as much as possible. And we all have a responsibility in these challenging times to, you know, to abide by the rules. So that was it, Ben. Just the whole place is shut down, and it looks like we're going to be shut maybe, Ben, for, you know, I don't know, maybe 4 to 6 weeks minimum.
That's it. I guess the whole thing is we just don't know. And while we don't know, I mean, we're talking about such a serious matter here that nothing can be taken for granted. And hopefully our friends across the border there will gain a bit of gumption at some stage and follow suit, because, you know, with us being over and back, we can't, you know, you're talking about schools there, John, you know, surely the schools in the north have to follow suit in terms of that and business. I mean, it's not as if people are deciding to do this without proper reasoning and the right precaution. So are you surprised about the schools in there being a principal?
I am, Ben, but like I've seen straight away that on Friday, I'm in St Bernard's, which is a special school in Little Angels, with the other special school in Letterkenny, and a lot of the children with underlying health conditions, Brendan, and compromised immune system. So I know that there's 10 special schools in the Belfast area. They all closed themselves, and there's a good few other schools, Brendan, have closed. And it's kind of funny the way it goes along, you know, green and orange. You see a lot of the Catholic schools in the north kind of have shut up, and they've taken the decision themselves, where maybe the other, you know, maybe the more Protestant schools are probably, you know, heeding the government warrants and maybe staying open. But I know, even from chatting to boys in the north, that they just kept their children at home, that even if the schools are open. So no, listen, Ben, I think, you know, problem with the north is they're being dictated by Boris Johnson, and that's the problem there. So, you know, it's a difficult situation for them. But no, I think everywhere should be close at this stage.
Clinging to the crown, the old Union boy. Uh-huh. It's interesting that, because I seen it, John. If you look, there was a mother from Armagh, in a regular school, and her daughter had serious asthma, and she was like, "Listen, what's going on here?" Because again, if you're putting even one life in jeopardy, you know that we can do something about it. And interesting as well, on the Premier League, you know, the government didn't tell the Premier League to shut down. They did it themselves. Like, you have this case of, surely it's a government that should be precautionary in all this, and yet, as you said, schools are taking it off, you know, their own, using their own intelligence to say, right, it's time to shut this down, not the government. But listen, every time you turn on the TV, there's a gaffe between Mr. Trump or Mr. Johnson, so I'm not actually expecting anything less from them. But John, just from the club perspective then, you're saying there's in terms of just now, it's kind of left open, isn't it, around what might happen for fixtures in the future? It's all about...
Yeah, Ben, it's going to cause a lot of hassle, you know, but I suppose the one thing I would say, that is, you know, it's exceptional circumstances, and whatever comes of it is going to come of it, and it's going to be for a short period of time, be it for this season, the 2020 season. Like, I seen last night on Twitter that the Limerick County Board, and then I see today the Dublin County Board, they have cancelled all championship games in April, and they've said that they're going to probably have to restructure their championships. So they're probably playing in group stages, like ourselves in Donegal. So you're going to see a lot of that happening now, Ben, that, you know, club championships around the country are going to have to be restructured. What's going to happen in the National League, we don't know. What's going to happen in the Championship, we still don't know. You know, there's people calling for a straight knockout, old time sake, just to see what happens. But we'll just have to, you know, have to see what happens. But from the club point of view, Ben, yeah, it's going to be difficult, because, you know, some of the underage football has started already. They're the minors and things like that there. So, you know, it's going to put a lot of pressure on, you know, clubs getting, you know, just the logistics, Ben, of having pitches to train on. And, you know, when you think the minors will be over, then another team starts playing on a Wednesday night or whatever. And, you know, where are all these teams going to get playing the matches? But I think we can overcome that, Ben. But the other, you know, from a club point of view, there's a lot of income being lost, Ben. And I know it's not all about money, but it's vital to keep the club going. So, you know, our bingo's cancelled, and I see that most clubs have to cancel their bingo, and even things like lottos are being cancelled, you know, which takes in a lot of money for a lot of clubs. And, you know, the bills probably still have to be paid. All right, we're not paying out as much at the minute because there's no teams training and buses aren't going and different wee things like that. But, you know, your insurance has to be paid and the registration fees, and, you know, you have to keep all them things, bills paid. So it's going to have a lot of clubs hired financially, Ben, because the lotto for a lot of clubs is a big income, and the bingo. So just, you know, things like that there is going to make it hard on clubs to, you know, get over this difficult period.
Yeah, John, these are all, I suppose, the small things we're looking at, you know, initially, because we're so in love with sport, I suppose, we're like, what's happening? But listen, this is so serious that it doesn't really matter in terms of, listen, whatever way we got to finish competitions, we got it. The financial side of it's a bit scary, John, but like everything, you know, people, I suppose, looking firstly towards their own finances and how that can happen, but of course, knock on to everybody else. And hopefully, John, we can contain this and
right,
take
folks,
it through. Listen, thanks so much for joining us and being those parts.
And McGinley, a man that's seen it and won it and done everything in the game, currently has a very insightful article with Irish News, I must say, and I steal some of his points and from time to time use them as my own. He works alongside me for Wee Station in the North, covering some games, which is always good to get. Enda McGinley, how are you today, sir?
I am great, Bran. Looking out at a pretty horrible rainy view over the Clare Valley here, so, but yeah, no, always good to be talking to you.
We're waiting on St. Patrick to shine on us here, and you know, these storms never seem to end. You're up about Ballygolly, and we're just wondering here, at the minute, we're just chatting to John Harney's chairman of St. Junan's about the shutdown and that, but as yet up your way, it's been a bit partial, I suppose. Some people are deciding to go ahead and do their own thing and take the advice of many of the medical experts, but some people are just hanging on waiting for the government to call it.
Yeah, it's pretty messy up here, and I suppose we're in the position where we can see pretty clear actions being taken in the south, and while they may or may not be over the top actions, at least everybody's on the one plan. Up here, the government is essentially behind the curve in terms of the public mood for taking action. So, like Boris Johnson last week, no need for the big closures, no need for cancellation of anything. The very next day, several huge sporting events were all cancelled from the sporting bodies themselves. So, and we're seeing, I just got a text today, there just literally an hour ago, that the local primary school, the local three primary schools, the Board of Governors have decided to close them. Well, not close them, they've brought forward the teacher training days for the rest of Wednesday, Thursday, Friday this week. So the school's effectively shut ahead of expected government announcement again. And that's quite a widespread thing that's happening, that Board of Governors are choosing to close the schools ahead of the health minister or ahead of any government announcement. So it leaves it very, very messy. It certainly leaves it messy for parents. Everybody's sort of in a loop. There's restaurants and that text and that they're shutting down as well, again, from their own thing. So it's pretty messy, and that doesn't help the general sense of unease and panic and strangeness that I think everybody's experiencing at the minute. It's, and it's a widespread effect. It's certainly nothing that any of us have ever seen before, and it's not particularly pleasant.
And I think the big thing here is that, you know, if one set of people are, you know, taking the caution that they should and listening to medical experts, you have other gang of people there and just seem to be, this is normality. You're looking at them thinking, right, what's the point? I mean, it's almost as if you got people talking about self-isolating. It's almost a lot of people have kind of gone into that mode as well, which I think is the right thing to do. And then you hear of so many other things happening out there. But listen, we can only do what we can do, Ian, and hopefully that advice comes down the line soon. And I wanted to talk to you just quickly about, I have to say, well done. First, your under-20s topped theirs in the Ulster final. Mm-hmm. Ongoing battle between Tyrone and Donegal at every level just does not seem to ever dissipate at all. I just wonder then, have you a few Argyll boys involved in that, and what was the vibe around Tyrone? Because not taking away from the competition of that, you know, it's a big competition, particularly at that grade that you're at there. And I'm just wondering, with the popularity of the senior game going up and up, to me, and I don't know about you, it seems like our underage stuff doesn't get maybe the coverage and it deserves.
Absolutely. Like, I would imagine, I didn't get to see the game, but I'd imagine, like, I worked with Moan Club Minors, which actually included several of the boys that were playing for Tyrone in the Ulster final. And it was brilliant quality football, like the club minor game. It was just brilliant football and thoroughly enjoyed it. And we got great crowds out because the quality of football actually in many ways was nicer to watch than the senior football, which really pushes down into the tactical line, maybe to its damage. I'd imagine County under 20 level is something similar. Coaches don't have enough time with the teams, and teams don't know each other well enough. There's too big of a change every year for teams to get into really deep-seated tactical battles, and so there's a wee bit more of a natural football feel to it, which is brilliant. It'll still obviously have the modern tactics in it, but in many ways, the underage football, as you see at schools level, can be brilliant football. I would have a real soft spot for underage football and would always believe that you're as likely to see a really entertaining game there as you are at senior level, you know. So absolutely, and from a Tyrone Donegal point of view, yeah, it, I suppose for me it really kicked off whenever Jimmy McGuinness came into Donegal, and the level Donegal were at just came up and up and up, and Tyrone were really the only team that were in a position to respond, and at that stage they just kept on Donegal's coattails. Now they've probably moved a wee bit ahead again, but certainly right throughout the grades, I think Donegal and Tyrone, maybe Monaghan in behind it, but certainly Donegal and Tyrone have been keeping each other pushing on. I think it's a pretty healthy rivalry, to be honest.
Interesting, I suppose. And I wonder if we had had it right today, Rory Cavanagh was going to be in here, and I was going to just let the 2 years or involve points that involved the 2 years, because at that time, just looking on, you know, just going into that period with Jim there, that it looked like Hart didn't go all the way tactically. You know, he went so far, he still wanted to play his own system, and Donegal had gone to the real depths of tactical from everything they were going to do, you know, from the lead-up to tactics on the pitch, matchups.
And their preparation level too, Brendan, we were all talking about it, like looking in from the outside, hearing stories of the training level that Donegal were doing, you know, the early morning or these really prolonged sessions of the huge running things. Mm. Training at county level, certainly within Tyrone, had moved away from that a wee bit as well, as sort of, them old days of the long slogs were gone. Jim McGuinness brought it back, and the level he pushed them boys to execute them defensive tactics, and absolutely, Tyrone were left completely in the lurch. I remember clearly the Tyrone training sessions that we had
following the first couple of times we met Donegal and came up against this tactics. And looking back now, it was really the height of naivety. We really didn't understand what was going on because the whole heart tactic was always then, right, well, we attack even faster. If we kick the ball long, we'll get back ahead of the boys that are retreating back. And that was the thrown thing, to just speed up and speed up and speed up and try and really rush into it. Of course, we now know that the last thing to do is to try and force and rush your attack, because that's sort of given the turnovers that the defensive shape is wanting to live off, if you know what I mean. And the thing was that it wasn't that Donegal ever left themselves exposed. So whenever we tried to break up the pitch and kick long balls in, they were sitting with one or two men already sitting back anyway, if you know what I mean. So you weren't getting back, getting to attack ahead of them. They were sitting back. So it took several years for Tyrone to really see what they were dealing with. And in the end, what they ended up doing was trying to replicate it. And unfortunately for me, that has left Tyrone on the catch up. We're reacting and we're ending up copying, and we're still trying to come up with a new style that we're comfortable with. I think that has coincided with a significant change over in personnel and a significant change in talent level, maybe restricted in terms of up front. And I think that has tied Mickey's hands in terms of the options that he can explore to try and come up with his own new style. And Tyrone, for me, are still very much finding their feet.
Yeah, very perfect. And just one, if you look at the Donegal progression, and particularly that game in 2011 in particular, while most of that three in a row team were in the round that era, and Donegal obviously were targeting Tyrone because Armagh were on the slide at that time. That first half where Tyrone created 18 scoring chances, Donegal created 5 and went down 2 points down. Tyrone had a good goal chance as well. And sometimes a team needs a start, and I think that's where Donegal rode their luck, and then obviously in the second half. But just on Hart's tactics, and I thought he was a bit stubborn, that he never seemed to want to match what Donegal was doing. And it went as far, I think, down to 2016 when he finally said, right, you want to play that deep, we'll play that deep. And we've seen that horrific game there. I know you don't want to maybe criticise Hart, you'll probably run under them in the shop later on today or something, but you know, I thought that was the final end that proved, right, if we're going to play at this tactics, and then the game has gone down the Swanee big time. But Tyrone held their nerve that day and beat Donegal, and since then it's been over and back and over and back. And as you say, the new styles is coming in now, and thankfully it's opened up, and the scoring rate has gone up as well. We just have to get used to a different style of football, but I must say it is getting more intriguing. The fitness levels and the skill levels has gone up, and I think from that perspective, so is the excitement as well.
Yeah, I think absolutely. I think we've turned the corner. But going back to your first point about back in 2011 and Hart not really wanting to go fully down that lane, you're absolutely spot on, and this is why I always sort of find it so sort of ironic, or it shows maybe the lack of real awareness in the general commentary that's out there, where Tyrone is essentially labelled as puke football. If you asked a simple straw poll down south about which teams brought in the defensive football, Tyrone would be right up there. And yet it was, I remember all the transitions under Hart. That was the absolute antithesis of what Hart was about. Like, I mean, people, probably myself included, but everybody got it at some stage, getting hung out to dry if you were to be seen just running back, not actually, and filling space. I mean, he went through you for a shortcut. That was never, ever allowed. You had to be pushing up. You had to be tackling. That's why the great Tyrone Kerry sequence that is shown again and again of Tyrone tackling, that was on Kerry's 45-yard line, where our defenders and forwards and midfielders and everybody was up there. The whole emphasis, drill after drill after drill, we done where the defenders were given the ball and the full forward line had to turn them over high up the pitch and get attacking. So the thought of retreating back and running back and playing what we now know as defensive football was the absolute opposite of everything Hart believed in. So, and whenever Donegal came with them tactics to us, and to be absolutely honest, it was Dublin first played against us with them, they give us the kickouts. Our attitude was attack fast, and that was Hart's initial automatic response, right, well, let's just do what we do, let's attack them even faster then. And of course then eventually, having failed to beat McGuinness over several occasions, he realised where the game was going, and also the change in the Tyrone personnel probably forced his hand that he had to go further into the defensive role. And to be fair, Tyrone became competitive again, turned the corner, and as the game has changed then, Tyrone has tried to change with it. But I think Again, I've said it a few times, I suppose, but the lack of out-and-out star quality up front limits slightly the Tyrone options in that regard. But the whole thing that Tyrone were at the vanguard of this defensive football, it wasn't. It did change in our time a bit, where forwards became much more intensely involved in terms of defensive effort, but it was in the forward line. Then Donegal, Dublin, brought in a new thing where they were given kickouts and they were getting high numbers back behind the ball, and that sort of changed, and Tyrone evolved quite late to the game in that respect, because it is completely against Hart's first modus operandi. But bottom line, Hart want to win games, and he eventually changed the style to get him back on the front foot.
You know, that is so interesting, and especially with Rory Cavanagh coming on now, because you're right, even in my mind, I kind of had Tyrone as a semi-defensive team. You know, I knew about the high work rate and obviously the quality they had, but I always had this assumption that there was a big defensive, you know, area did, as in dropping people back. And that makes so much sense, because it must be so hard for Hart to say, right, I've won all Ireland's playing this way. I've got this talented bunch that keep coming through. I've always got players coming through. I don't want to play that way. And I suppose Donegal eventually forced them in 2016 to say, right. And meanwhile, as we created all this defensive situation, you just got tired with the same brush. My apologies absolutely. About that.
No, absolutely. Like, I mean, we won our minor All-Irelands and under-21 All-Irelands with that group, obviously under Hart. And it was just pure football. You'd never done even fitness training. He expected you to be fit coming to training, and then he just wanted to play football. It was all skills. And at bottom line, he had a forward line of McGuigan, of Canavan, of O'Neill, of Muggsy, of Jared Calvin back at the start,
right,
too.
Jared Calvin, like, that's right.
My one role, I was sort of featured in that forward line. I was the one person, so I came out to midfield as essentially a third midfielder and an extra half forward, and you have Duher, the dynamo, who was up and down the pitch the whole time. But that wasn't exactly revolutionary. Pat Spillane was doing that, you know, so, but again, don't get, and if you look back at them games from the noughties, they were phenomenal games of football, and they weren't the defensive thing. You sometimes ended up back in defence simply because you never were allowed to stop. You had to tackle and tackle, and if that meant going back, then went back. But never ever were you allowed to just run back into the defensive shape. It was, oh, jeepers, you got lynched.
Do you know,
if you were seen to be standing in a space.
Do you know what I think that part of that was in? That you'd upset the aristocrats, you know. People couldn't understand that people didn't have enough time in the ball to display their beautiful skills. These boys from the north were getting about them. I think that probably brought into the whole situation. And by God, they just get about them. And just a quick word before I let you go there on the club scene. Big buzz about Donegal here. You know, we've Ulster champions 2 years ago, Gidor. We Kilcarvan the final year before. And again, Niamh Collin. You know, we've suddenly kind of turned the corner in terms of our club teams competing. Just what the vibe is. Trillick this year, you know, big talk of him getting into the Ulster. Is there anybody from the Tyrone club scene you think could get in and win an Ulster? It's been a while now. What about your own club?
Argyll obviously has our proud record in Ulster. We're the only Tyrone team to have ever won in Ulster, getting two titles in our time. For me, as an Argyll man, we should have had more. Certainly other Tyrone clubs should have had it. Yet we are massively proud of the club game in Tyrone. Like, the club championship draw was
huge.
made several weeks ago, and just tie after tie is massive, massive games. And like, you mingle widely, and everybody is very proud of the game. And the thing we're all open about, there is any one of about 8-9 teams can go and win that championship, and nobody is guaranteed. And all of them teams are an exceptionally high level. They take their football massively serious. Like, I see what the Moan club, the Argyll lads, the level they're preparing themselves to. It is massive. It is essentially, I would imagine, if you take a Division 4, Division 3 county team, that's the level that the top teams in Tyrone are pushing themselves to. Why they don't then be able to hit whenever it comes to Ulster? Some say it's because it's so hard to win Tyrone that it takes the value of them. I don't buy into that, to be honest. I think sometimes getting a consistent run at the Ulster club, getting there 3, 4, 5 times in a row, like what Kilcoo have done, I think that gives you the big game experience. That and that sort of season championship thing. Whereas in Tyrone, you could be out in the first round. Multiple county champions have been out in the first round over the past few years. So suddenly teams aren't getting that year on year, pushing at the top, prolonged championship runs to develop the experience that coming to Ulster club is absolutely critical. Ulster club winter football
is not about beautiful football. It's about a really experienced, hard, grinding out football where mistakes will be made, but the team remains solid and solid and solid. Cross McGlenn, Slough Neil, obviously two brilliant exponents of it, but and Kilcoo have hardened themselves over the years, and they're now that team as well. So you sort of see what Ulster club teams are, and because of the nature of the Throne team, the Throne Championship, what we had eight different winners over eight different years there, you know, so you feel to get that experience built up, and that probably is the Achilles heel at the minute.
Yeah, and listen, first class as usual. Thanks very much for that point of view. I'll be throwing your points across to Rory Kavanagh now when we review his book here, Winning. And thanks for joining us in the DL Debate.
No problem, Brent. Good chatting to you.
Yes, folks, right now in the DL Debate, he should have been in studio with me, but we have him on the line as we're keeping it all things sanitised at the minute. The one and only Rory Kavanagh is on the line. Rory, how are you?
Brendan, how's things? Are you well?
Very best, sir, very best. A man that's done practically everything in the game, and they say bought the t-shirt. Well, you wrote the book Winning, which I was having a read through last night, and I was telling you, Rory, I obviously bought a copy at the time. I think he signed it for me and I lent it to someone. Well, they kind of took it on me and never gave it back. One low. So that's the light of Rory sold me on a book there, Kenneth. He gave me a euro off it just, but well worth the read, my man. Well worth the read. But Rory, listen, I was just up. Listen, the book is absolutely fascinating. Listen, top drawer. It starts with a boom. You know, I'm just thinking there's a lot of Netflix being watched at the minute, Rory. And the start of a Netflix episode has to grab you. And this book certainly does that. It just starts with a whirlwind bang. Now, what I was thinking was, Rory, in the lead up to this book, and I always think about people that do books and that, was it something was in your head, and where did Liam Hayes come out of, and how did the whole thing formulate?
I suppose, Brendan, it was 2015, like after the All-Ireland in 2014, I decided to step away, and I was the only player out of the panel that had decided to retire. So Liam approached me, I think it was February of 2015 that he approached me. He rang me up one day when I was at work and just introduced himself really and asked, you know, would it be interested in meeting him. And I suppose at the time, like, Donegal's story was obviously very much in the public domain, and there was a lot of interest, and I suppose there was a desire to find out what the setup was like under Jim McGuinness. So I suppose it just originated out of that, like, and he came up and met me a couple of times in my house, over that spring. And it was just something then we decided to go with, you know. He was more convincing on Liam Hayes' part, because initially I was skeptical enough, Brendan, whether to go down the road of telling a book. But, you know, the more he talked to me, and the more he persuaded me, listen, there's going to be a great appetite among the general public for this story to be told, because realistically, Donegal came out of nowhere, like, you know, and in the space of 4 years, you know, really stamped their authority on the game, both in Ulster and at all Ireland level. So
we were down about what was it, 19? Where you were saying was quoted. We were in the country. It's hard to believe we were at that level, and that was before the start of 2011.
Exactly, like, you know, and that was, I suppose, something that Jim really latched on to as well. You know, we obviously had that famous meeting down in Downing's, where he took out the Irish News, and, you know, he was visibly chewing on the fact that we're number 19 in the country, like, and we spent a long time going over, you know, what was going wrong in years previous. And basically formulating plans to, you know, get us back to the top table, and identifying what exactly was the problem, you know, because there had been many, I suppose, bad defeats in the years previous. And I suppose, like, we were accused really of throwing in the towel in many big games, Brendan, you know.
Before that was I was there in the middle of all them, and
We'll get into a few of them games. So firstly, a bit like last week, having to talk to John Gaudet and Bradis about 2005, Rory, I can't avoid things, I guess. Sometimes memory lane can be a tough one, but listen, that was then, and you know, everybody's had ups and downs. You know, Rory, you've seen both sides of it, which I find fascinating. Of course, Rory, the book, and Hayes was 100% right, was going to be, you know, fascinating around giving a bit of insight and date, and some of the descriptions, you know, in the book, it sounds like it's coming from you, but you know, you're a great talker, Rory, and I listened to you on the TV, you were able to speak it, but Hayes gave him a few wee twists, I would imagine. I like some of his description now, particularly around Clonus on a hot day and that. Now, it might have been you on that, take it away from me. But Rory, I'm just thinking about the, now of course, the close-knit thing of the group and that, and the fact that you were first to come out with the book, were you worried about that side of it? Was there times you were holding back saying, should I give this away? This was part of what we had as a bond, or did you think, hey, I'm retired now, I can say what I want?
That was always, I suppose, in the back of your mind, like, you know, that you'd been part of this setup for so long. And you didn't maybe want to go down the road of disclosing sort of dressing room secrets and things like that, you know, but I think the fact that there was a clean break, that I wasn't involved anymore, and I suppose Jim wasn't involved anymore, there was going to be a new manager coming in, with his own ideas, on how to take maybe Donegal forward. You know, it made that decision a wee bit easier, Brendan, you know. Mm. And of course, like, Liam wanted to know every last detail in terms of, you know, how we're setting up and players that were to man mark opposition players and, you know, our preparations and our training schedule and all the rest. So a part of me, you know, was worried, you know, and it was one of these situations where you couldn't really confide in anybody either. You know, couldn't really go and tell any of the lads because obviously they were still involved in that bubble. And I know, like, when you are involved, that's the only thing you think about. You know, it's you're preparing for games. And so part of me, was torn in a way, like, because there was a lot of to and fro initially whether, you know, should go and do this here, because you just didn't want to break that bond that you had between the players, but it was inevitable, I suppose, that it was going to come after I'd retired.
I don't think there was, it's not as if there was big bombshell things in there, you know, there's always going to be a bit of insight given eventually when things change and that, Rory. So listen, you know, I just think it, Rory, about as a player, you know, you look back and I suppose it's nice for you individually to have your whole career there and then, because I find when I look back over the years, I can't really remember sometimes what game was what or what year was what. It's kind of like a, you know, a haze of different motions. So some of them are larger than others and you remember them and remember them well, but there are loads that don't. As you look back, did you need loads of pointers around this happened here, this happened there? I know the current stuff, sure, would have been right on the top of your mind, but looking back in the previous years, was it hard to remember some of the stuff that happened? Was the research needed to be done?
No, there was, like, and I suppose that's where Liam came in, you know, and he was able to rejog my memory in a lot of the games because
Liam, tell me what happened.
Like, you would actually remember more stuff that went on after games and different things than you would during the games, and like, you know, he was pointing out wee things that were happening in games, and this happened, that happened that year, and of course, like, you forget, you know, but going back to your point there, you know, of actually doing the book, you know. I have three kids now, you know, and my middle, I have two boys, one's two, one's three, and the oldest girl is six, but it's kind of nice, it's nice for them now, like, because my middle fella there, who's three, he's absolutely, you know, devout almost when it comes to Gaelic football, and he goes around, you know, with this book in his hand, and he's pointing out to the pictures, and who's that fella, and who's that player, and who's that player. So he's running around the hall now pretending he's Michael Murphy most of the time, you know. So it's kind of nice for them to, it's almost a keepsake, do you know what I mean? And the fact that they were obviously too young, and some of them weren't even born when all of this was happening, so it's kind of a nice memory for them, you know.
That's why you kept a few of them
more dodgier stories from from 2011 out. Thank you for not naming names. You know, there's so much in this. As I said to you on the phone last night, you know, we want to do this in two parts, because there's two parts to your life in GAA, you know, in county terms, so in terms of pre-McGuinness and pre-after. So we're going to take you up to 2011 and, of course, everything in between, and then take it on from there and really go through, you know, that whole period. You know, such a fascinating period for everybody involved in county football in Donegal. You know, it was a magical time. But Roy, just taking you right back to the start, you know, growing up in Letterkenny, you know, you fancied yourself as a bit of a soccer player. I never really rated you as one, but you fancied yourself a bit. No, only joking. I know you're well able to play soccer, but you were playing soccer in Gaelic. You were out at the park, went to St. Union's College, and you know, you would have played there along with likes of Colin McFadden and a few lads and fellas that you were going to play with, you know, Conal Dundee, lads, club and county in the years going forward.
Aye, well, you know, we moved out to Oaklands Park here now in 87, so I was five, like, and I kind of, with the McLaffertys obviously living across the road, great football and dynasty themselves, the seven boys. And Adrian,
a few of them
Damien
better than others,
Niall,
but we'll not name names.
All hardy backs, all hardy backs, like, you know, just couldn't
backs.
Play football, but just they could play, take plenty of boys out of the game. But you know, you had Sean McEwen over the road there as well, who obviously played, you know, and a couple of others, Eddie Brennan down the road as well from us. So, like, it was Martin Rafferty initially that kind of got me involved with the club, and you know, I remember him coming up in their council van, like, and asking me would I get involved, and I think it was under 12, under 14 at that stage, like, but, you know, that's the way it was done back then. You know, he actually landed to my door and asked would I think about coming out and play with St. Junan. So That was kind of me then, kind of latched on. As you said, I played a lot of soccer as well, and that continued soccer and Gaelic right the way up till I was probably 18, and it was then that you kind of decided maybe to take Gaelic football more seriously. So, but look, we had great days with you know, St. Junan's, and, you know, good teams. We got to a minor final, got beat by Buncrana, and then we managed to win an under 21, with St. Junan's, and that was a big moment for us, like, cause, suppose it was quite a few years since we maybe had one, like, so it was a big breakthrough for us, and fortunately you had three or four of that team that, you know, continued on into the senior setup, you know, and we were always very fortunate. I always think, you know, that we came into a team, you know, with the likes of yourself and Mark Crossan and Johnny Scanlon, John Harn, all these boys that were kind of seasoned veterans at the stage, and, you know, who were used to winning, and obviously in 97 and 99, and really and truly, you boys were the fellas that we looked up to, you know, and we were kind of just tagging along for the ride in many of those years. So,
well,
so
listen, like, we had seen a bit of class, and you were far from tagging along. Funny, Roy, you gave me a lovely quote at the start of the book. I'd like to spend the next 10 minutes talking about that, but we'll move quickly on. But Roy, listen, of course, the Mad Kavanagh family as well, you know, we have to give them a shout, Barry, Alma and Nuna and Donna and Mum and Dad, and the don't mess with Rory, my wee Rory, the famous comment from the family video that McGavish.
Agnes
No more to Agnes. Right, of course, yeah, the fanatical family, I suppose, no more than my own, and the two families knowing each other very well. Rory, I still remember 2001, that was your first county senior championship, yeah?
And I think 2002. It was Mickey Moore, and I think it was give me my
the actual St. Junan's. St. Junan's.
Oh, sorry, St. Junan's. Sorry, yeah, St. Junan's. Yeah.
Because
I can
actually still remember just yourself and Don. We were down the Pulse having a shandy, and because there was so much buzz about 97, and then the whole handling in 99, which there was such a lift off. Of course, Junan's hadn't won a championship since 83 at that time, and then all of a sudden it became a wee bit kind of routine that we were in finals and out of finals. And I remember, actually still remember you on about different memories, kind of apologising to you and Conor saying, you was usually far more cracked at this, but we've all got a wee bit sensible. So that kind of maybe goes against some of the boozing stories that'll happen down the road from this story. But I remember you was coming in 2001. And then when was it that you joined up with the senior Donegal team?
It was the following year. So, I think it was Mickey Moore that, you know, we were just coming out under 21 at the time. So, it was Mickey Moore and John Morrison were in charge of Donegal. Like, so I remember getting my first sort of minutes in a senior jersey in the championship, in Ulster championship game, I think against Down that year, I think over in Balbuffet. I think you actually might have scored a goal or two that game. So, we actually went in a good run. I think we ended up in an Ulster final that year, against Armagh. Mm. But,
McGuinness was playing
Jim, I would have been like, you know,
he got a goal actually. He got a goal in the final actually. You're bringing it back to me now, Roy.
So yeah, now listen, that was the first one. Like, but listen, again, Donegal at that time, you know, had very very talented players, you know, and I suppose it was the Armagh hoodoo that was over us at that time. Like, you know, we always seemed to crash against the rocks when it came up against Armagh. But like, again, very, very talented players, you know, and then I was a forward probably trying to break into that team, and there was just probably no breaking into it. You know, you had probably four out of the six forwards anyway that were more or less nailed on, you know, between yourself and Eddie in the full forward line. And, you know, you'd Roper obviously and Michael Hegarty and these boys in the half forward line. So it was formidable enough to try and break into that sort of team as a young player. But, it was great to sit and learn, obviously. And it was like, I played under six different managers. That's so right. It took a wee bit of learning out of everybody, Bryn.
Yeah, yeah. And don't worry, just taking you out of county and club for a second. There's something that I might not have said to you before. I still remember me and Colin Parkinson were good friends, obviously. And I remember him on about you playing for Maynooth, actually. And he said to me, I remember him telling me, he says, what's the story using Donegal? This Kavanagh man should be playing midfield for Donegal. And this is when you were around that kind of half-forwardy kind of area. But whatever performance you must have put in for Maynooth, he says you were catching balls, the leap in the spring that we would get to know later on. He had seen it from way back then, from Maynooth times, and said, this guy should be playing midfield for Donegal.
I went down there in 2000, and actually, you know, it's just bizarre the people and the friendships then that you strike up. You know, you'd obviously Woolley Parkinson was down there, you'd Alan Brogan at the time, John Keane, who was an all-star cornerback for Westmeath, and they were kind of in their third year of Maynooth when I was just coming into my fresher year, so I only got to really play with them for a year. But you know, then you had other players then. You know, Alan Dillon from Mayo, who would play against them in the 2012 All-Ireland Final, and Mark O'Shea, who would play against in the 2014 All-Ireland Final. So, you know, it's kind of, you go down there not knowing anybody, and in many ways, football was almost the saviour, because initially I found it, God, you know, most of my mates had gone to Dublin or Galway or whatever the case may be, but I seemed to be kind of the only one from Letterkenny down there. But you strike up friendships straight away through the football, and you have those friendships ever since. Like, yeah.
It's one of the great sides of the game, Rory, and it's lasting, as you say, and you know you can call on them guys any time, you know. And Rory, just thinking then, you know, as time went on then, after Mickey Moore, well, one thing about Mickey Moore before we leave that, the famous bus story, about half the bus after that draw with Dublin got home or not. And I want you to say, now, were you or were you not in that bus, or were you in Temple Bar and the Fat Frogs? Let's have it though.
You actually dragged me off that bus at the time. I think you were saying, "Here, Keir Cabs, come on, I'll give you a lift up to Donegal the following day."
I actually got a bit
you
of
see,
sense.
We
of it.
Have to be exalted from all blame in this here, because you know we were the young guys on the panel. We were being led by the older,
so you're saying yes is the answer. So, well, that's okay.
The unconfirmed reports.
the folly of youth. We'll blame it on that, Rory. So, Moran leaves, and your next manager in then is
Brian McNiff.
Was McNiff in between now, or was he?
Brian McNiff came in then.
It was a year.
2003, wasn't it? Actually, 2003, I went to Boston then, because right. I was finishing up, sort of my youth. That was my last year, and had decided, you know, that I'd go and play football in Boston for the summer. So I missed out on all that run. You know, I was watching on in the States. He's went in that, great run through the qualifiers and ended up in an All-Ireland semi-final. And I was going, Christ mighty, look, these boys are going to end up in an All-Ireland final this year. So, you know, that was 2003, like, so, it was just a decision, I suppose, that I had taken earlier on in the year, and it was nothing against anybody else. It was just one of these things that you'd made a commitment, and maybe during the winter, and the summer came around, and I was always going to go, so that's the way it transpired, you know.
And it was then, Rory, in McGavers' stint then that you got your first start?
You know, and I say this to the young fellas in the development squads, like, you know, I broke on or came onto the panel in 2002 and didn't get sort of my first start in 2006. So there was like, there was 4 years there of sort of persevering, like, and I always give that message to the young fellas, like, you know, and there was probably many times that I discussed this with you or Mark Crossan, you know, and wanting to maybe walk away and go back to soccer or do something like, but I always knew that I loved sort of the game and, you know, the friendships that I had in the panel. And, so it was important for me to probably just stick around and persevere, as I said, and finally got that break, in 2006 under Brian McGiver. So, it ended up being another sort of good year for me personally. Like we went all the way. I think that we went to the Ulster final that year, Brendan, against Armagh. It was up in Croke Park, actually. It was a kind of, you had a series of games, Ulster finals being played in Croke Park back in that time. I think from 2004, 5 and 6 were all played at Croke Park. And you know, again, a big learning curve for us, and it was our third Ulster final defeat since 2002 at the hands of Armagh. I think, you know, we got beat by a goal, but just again, didn't really show up on the day, maybe the occasion, different things, but ultimately, you know, Armagh were season campaigners and big, physical, strong unit, and probably just toughed it out in the day, and we weren't able to match that sort of physicality they were bringing to the table, or that cuteness, you know.
Yeah, and I think really the thing with Armagh was, you know, they'd got tactical, they started in weights, they were doing a lot of things we weren't doing, and they were ruthless, whereas we, and everyone who came to us, Roy, and they were great coaches, all the guys there that you mentioned, but we all tried to play our own brand of football, and as we see later on down the line, if a team is set up a bit defensively or gets a bit rigid or gets that belief in them, you know, as Donegal did, they become very hard to beat. So we kept sticking to our guns in our games. And just speaking to Enda McGinley previously about Mickey Hart and his mantra, you know, I think that's many of the reasons Donegal kind of held that Indian sign over Tyrone for a good few years, is because Hart wouldn't change his tactics until, as we've seen, 2016, and we've seen what happened there. So that's very interesting stuff. Rory, just your club now was going through a bit of a tough time, just around this time as well. Rory, we were every year in the round the supposed favourites for the title, and we had lost a couple in a row, a bit like the Niamh Collins situation. This year we finally got across the line with Brendan Kilcoyne and Glenn Swilly in 2007. And then, Rory, we went on a bit of a run. I think the following year, you'd agree with me, was the best we ever did when O'Boyd came in, Mickey McGeehan. And we were really moving up the gears. We literally blew everybody away in Donegal.
And we went down to Ulster, and I think we were ready the first time. I think, O'Brien, I'll be straight up, in my heart of hearts, the only time I felt we could have tilted it. And again, go back to tactics, Rory. If you look at Niamh Connell within in the first year, and it was one of the first years that I was covering games at 2005, got to an Ulster final against, of course, Cross McGlenn, our old nemesis, Armagh County, Cross McGlenn and club. it was one of those things kept coming up. But they played a system, I think, Roy, which protects you in Ulster in terms of finding your way into the game on a strange team, on a strange ground, find your way into the game, playing a system which protects you. We would then just played our normal football, and that's why, particularly, it was nearly always Cross that beat us. You're crashing up against a real warhorse of a team. But I felt 2008 we got the mix right between our defensive, our fitness and our attack. Then, of course, we beat Clonoe in the first game away, and then I punctured a lung myself and nearly went under. But you know, we had crossed that next game again, and I think that was the one year probably you'd think from a unit's perspective we could actually won an Ulster, you know.
Well, definitely that was our best chance, and you know, we had chances that day. You know, I think back to Ross Wherdy's one he was going through, and I think it was the goalkeeper hurt. He got a touch on it with his backside actually, and it just trickled wide of the post. But you know, that goes in, and it's a 4-point game, and it's a different game altogether. But I think, you know, your loss was a very big one, like, for us, because you know, obviously you were our chief score getter. And focal point in that full forward line, and going into that game without you was a big loss to us. But we did, absolutely, we played very, very well for large parts of the game, and probably went in at half time leading Bryn, and deservedly so, and probably had other chances to be further ahead. I think we were 2 points ahead, but there was just that critical juncture. The Cross made a couple of changes. Francie Bellew came out to centre back, and you know, a few other positional changes. And I remember Tony McEntee landing a monster of a score from the far touchline. You know, just one of these scores that he had no right to kick, and it was a levelling score and a big, big moment in the game. And next thing, the momentum switched totally, like, and then all of a sudden we were finding it hard to get any sort of possession, and they had just that habit, didn't they, of eking out results, you know, you know, when they weren't maybe at their best. But going back to your point, that was definitely our best time to leave an impression in Ulster, because there's no doubt about it, like, you know, when we'd won 3 in a row, in Donegal, like, it was time to do something in sort of Ulster. But you know, unfortunately, we weren't able to do that, you know.
Yeah, that's it, right. And this, we're jumping you back into your county career now again. We're at the John Joe Doherty phase. Now, the thing about John Joe is, and things went really bad under his tenure, and listen, John Joe was a captain when I joined Donegal in 1997, and you know, a bit like that, I was lucky enough, Rory, into the team. I think maybe at times, certain positions, corner forward in them days, you could throw in a corner forward to have a go, whereas the position you were coming into, you needed to be like physically ready. Even though young lads are coming through physically ready now because of the training, at that time you had to fill out. It was just like a natural progression. So I was lucky, but John Joe, to this day, is still the best captain I've had. And I felt bad that things went so bad. But around that time, Rory, Donegal, that huge defeat against Cork. I can still remember you retreating back, Rory, in the round of 21 line, and Cork were bagging points for fun. Well, they had 27 points in the day. The following season, and of course, was a horror show up in Cross McGlenn. And just at that time, Rory, the vibe, what were you thinking? You know, because it almost as if, even though we didn't win an Ulster at that time, you were pretty close. And how did you feel then, just after that time? Did you think, you know, is there any future to this, or what was the mood between you and the lads?
Well, like, you know, John Joe came in after Brian McIver obviously had been there for 2 or 3 years, and kind of came in a cloud of controversy, really. Do you remember? There was a lot of to and fro on at county board level, and didn't really know who was going to get the job. But And transpired then, John Joe got it, I think, ahead of Declan and Charlie, and I think Jim McGuinness was actually, he had applied for it as well, like, so he came in sort of a cloud of controversy, like, but, you know, one of his first things to do was he got in contact with me and he says, listen, you're going to be captain this year, you know. And I was 27 at the time, Brendan, and probably playing good stuff at club level. And obviously we hadn't won a championship game at Ulster since maybe, I don't know, 2006 maybe or something like that under Brian. So we were kind of in a low ebb, like. So our first championship game, I remember, was against Antrim, you know, and like I felt that we were going pretty decently and fairly confident that, you know, we'd get a result in Ballybofey against Antrim. But what transpired then was a bit of a nightmare for us. Like, we kicked something like 22 wides that day, I remember, and, you know, we got beat by a point, and I just thought, this has just gone completely pear-shaped on us, you know. And personally then, you're kind of under your captaincy, you're under pressure straight away, like, and it was difficult, you know. You're going out to face the media and you're trying to keep things positive, and because you knew you had a qualifier run coming. And to be fair, we got a bit of a run in the qualifiers, Brendan. You know, we managed to pick up a couple of decent ones. I think against Clare and Derry, I think it was. So we kind of bounced back and found ourselves into a quarter final then against Cork and Croke Park. And again, you're going in optimistic, like, but again, what happened, as you say, we shipped something like 27 points that day. So, like, personally, you know, the head was spinning, like, and you were thinking, Christ, this is just, you know, it's going from bad to worse here. You know, we'd won a Division One league under Brian McIver, but again, we'd flopped in Championship under him. So we seem to be doing not well at all in the big games in Championship. And whatever reason that might have been, you mentioned, you know, did we need to go a wee bit more defensively? Did we need maybe a system that we could rely on in the heat of battle in the big games? Because there was no doubt we always had a sprinkling of talent, but whatever the case may be, we always seem to flop in the big championship games.
Get all the expectations up, and then I think that's the thing with Donegal all the time, Rory. You know, there'd be a couple of big ones in there. You would excite the public. I mean, Donegal fans were always mad to get behind the team. Then the big day would come, and it would be horrific. And then all the stuff would come out about it. And you know, I was just thinking, Rory, before we get on to 2011 and Jim's appointment. I'm just about the stories, you know. Some of them became folklore around, you know, there was a bit of trial here by Highland at the time. I used to call it trial by Hayden. People were here and there. And I think some of the things grew legs a lot, Rory. And I don't know what you think about it. I mean, some of us actually, like, there was a lot of laughing, used to go on about it and that. And there was kind of a bunch of lads who knew how to enjoy life, let's put it like that. And there was a few guys who took it too far. There was incidents come up and down. They shouldn't have happened, Rory. But I think once the door was left open in terms of, right, you can have a beer, some guys then couldn't handle that and it fell into stuff. And any of them moments where training was suspended a few times, I remember under McIver and a couple of things happened, they were tough on everybody. And there was loads of lads that were very committed then, Rory, and I always felt it was unfair that everybody was getting tired with the one brush then around these situations. And on top of that, Rory, and here's my point on it, but I think if we had won a couple of those Ulster finals, I don't think any of them stories would have come out. I think they come out because of defeats, and that's what happens, because then people are a wee bit let down by the whole situation. Then they see some guys maybe having a booze and that. If them guys had a one, they can booze all they want. What do you think about that?
Well, it's a fine line. Like, you know, I do take your point. Like, definitely that connection between the supporters and the team had been severed, and severed badly because of those bad defeats, like, and the manner in which they came. You know, you talk about that defeat against Cork, and, you know, obviously the year after then against Armagh and the qualifiers. So the supporters, you know, they pay their hard earned money in to see the team, and what they expect at the very least is that the team will leave it all out there in terms of their effort, in terms of that pride that they want to show in the jersey. And I think just, you know, in a few of those years, we did throw in the towel a wee bit too easy, Brendan.
There was no getting away with that. Totally agree.
To compound things then, you know, the stories came out then of maybe lads enjoying themselves into day two or day three or whatever the case may have been. Supporters just found that difficult to square away, and that was 100% true, and it was one of the things that we needed to address.
I think mentally we were brittle, and that's why your story is so interesting, that you come from one point to the other, you know, around. At the time, if somebody had sat you down and we really went through this, as we never did as a team or as a group of players, they were like, what do we exactly need to do? You know, we always kind of left it to managers, we train, we go home. We never had an in-depth look tactically at anything. And all of a sudden, in lands Jim, you know, and particularly, you know, Jim obviously had the under-21 success, took them kick of a ball away from winning all Ireland. But as you mentioned in your book, you know, when we won the final 2009 against Niamh Connell, playing that system, and Jim was on the line and giving it socks, and we had kind of, you know, I suppose in club terms, found a way to get around the system and it had won the match easily. And you were wondering then, you know, about the credentials of this man coming in. You obviously met him in the Clanree and spoke to him, but you had your doubts.
I suppose to put a bit of context on it, we're mentally, we're kind of in a bit of a mess. Like, you know, there was many of us, Ben, that were really contemplating of never playing again. That was the reality. Like, I remember against Armagh, you know, the Colin was substituted at one stage and the camera panned him at one stage, and he was just having an innocent conversation with somebody in the dugout, and he was appeared to be sort of smiling, and next thing the public kind of lashed onto this, and he got an awful lot of abuse for it, and Cass was for retiring, and I was probably the same, to be quite honest, you know, because we hadn't, as I said, won a game in Ulster since maybe to 2006, so there was a lot of that there that we needed to square away, and it was just like this man was coming in and he was talking about putting maybe medals in our pockets, Ulster medals, and you know, you were kind of thinking, is this man, you know, for real or what, you know? So there was a lot of that there, and Brendan, and I said he had a lot to sort out. You know, that connection that I said between the supporters and the team had gone, and I suppose Jim was determined not to see a repeat of what maybe happened to his team, you know, your team, that during the noughties, like, where that had got so far and had been in contested Ulster finals, but ultimately Armagh proved too good on all those occasions. And I'd say he was determined to come in and make football a number one priority for everybody in the county. And that had to come first, you know, and I remember him saying, listen here, you have to snap the ties here. You know, yeah, you gotta
don't be hanging
football
about B2V.
You gotta have
the spy out.
You gotta have football number one in your list of priorities.
Yeah, and you know what? And I think in many ways, Armagh, even though he went after Tyrone, Armagh, them crushing defeats that we said were Armagh were like a wall, you know, and we were brittle against them because they had built up this aura, and that's what he attempted to do. And funny, you talk about Jim and how he's talking, you're like, is this guy serious? You know, and Johnny the Butcher calling him last week on the phone, just around John Gilday and Brad is coming in, and he was saying, listen, Jim, they looked at him the same when he first came to Niamh Connell. He said, you know, the crazy genius line, you know, McGuinness just on the right side of the genius, and that's what he brought this, Rory. And, you know, we're getting into 2011, Rory. We're going to pick that up in part two, because this is when life changes, you know. Everything that Jim was asking you to do and the team to do, I think it's such a fascinating story, from the depths of where you are there, contemplating retirement,
little did you know, 2 years later, you were going to be lifting the Sam Maguire, Rory, and the pride of Donegal, and everyone was behind you. And of course, the couple of years that followed, Rory. So we're going to pick that up next week. We got rid of all the bad stuff now, Rory. It's on to the good stuff from next week. I'll give you a bell then, Rory Cavanagh, and thanks very much for chatting to us on the DL Debate. Right, folks, that's it for now on the DL Debate, episode 7. Can't wait to pick up the rest of the story with Rory Cavanagh next week. You know, the fascinating run to All Ireland, you know, the Kevin Cass story, you know, defending the title, you know, the whole situation between Rory and Jim. So much on this, you know. We'll be joined by a few other guests as well. So for now, I'd like to say thanks very much for Kenneth for producing the show, Oisin Kelly for Kieran Brogan, and of course Sister Sarah's our sponsor, and we'll pick this up again next week.
The DL Debate with Sister Sarah's Letterkenny, serving food you'll love till 9 p.m. daily in Sarah's Kitchen, and there's free admission entertainment every weekend.